Mesdames et messieurs, bonjour, bienvenue à tous. Welcome. Thank you very much for being here today at the second installment of the Andrew F. Holmes Dean of Medicine Distinction Lectures. On behalf of the Faculty of Medicine, I have to tell you the faculty is deeply honored to be able to have a lectureship in Dr. Holmes' name. Those who are aficionados of the history of the university will know that he was the first dean of the faculty. And the goal of these lectures is to provide a forum for our larger community in order to stimulate academic exchange. This lecture is made possible through the legacy and generosity of Rose Weiselberg. And the lectures salute those who are outstanding in health sciences while celebrating scholarship that is the backbone of everything we do in education, in research, and in healthcare at McGill. We hope that we're also opening doors to undergrad students, graduate students, and postdocs in order to give them an opportunity to learn from and exchange with leading individuals who really define excellence in the health sciences. And so it's great to see so many students here today. I'm very excited to welcome our lecturer this year, our distinguished speaker, Dr. Janet Rossent, who I'm going to introduce in a couple of minutes. But her presence here is particularly fitting, as she is one of the world's foremost researchers in the field of stem cell biology. And the reason that this is apropos is that prior to this event, I and many people in this room had the pleasure of participating in a ceremony in which we dedicated the histology lab, in which some of us spent many happy hours in this building, though they were happy hours, in honor of Dr. Yves Clermont, who is actually sitting here today. Dr. Clermont was and continues to be a legend in this faculty for his contributions, both scientific and educational. And judging by the smiles that I saw on the faces of fellow of other people who had the privilege of being taught by him, today was just a fabulous day to see him celebrated. So congratulations, Dr. Clermont. Now, just for those of a certain age that is younger than me, Dr. Clermont was a researcher who, together with Dr. C.P. Leblanc, after whom this amphitheater is named, as you know, who really were among the pioneers in identifying stem cells and the stem cell renewal theory. Today, stem cells have there's tremendous interest in stem cells as potentially of therapeutic use in everything from cancer to degenerative diseases. And in a certain sense, they're all derived from the seminal work that was published back in 1953, the same year that the double helix was reported. So, without further ado, I'd like to actually introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Janet Rossent. So Dr. Rossent was trained at both Oxford and Cambridge, and she moved to Canada in 1977, where she joined the faculty of Brock University. She subsequently became a leading researcher at the Samuel Lunenfeld Research Institute at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto between 1985 and 2005, and at that time she joined SickKids as their chief of research. She's also a professor at the University of Toronto and a world-renowned expert in developmental biology and in many ways embodies the very definition of a trailblazer. She's widely known for her studies in the genes that control embryonic development in the mouse, and she's pioneered techniques for following cell fate and altering genes in embryos. Her current research focuses on stem cell development and cell differentiation in the developing embryo, which are clearly important areas for the study of birth defects as well as for regenerative medicine. And on the front lines of technological change, Dr. Rossent has established SickKids as a global leader in genetic research. She's been recognized, as you might imagine, for her contributions with many awards. She's a recipient of the Killam's Prize in Health Sciences, the March of Dimes Prize in Developmental Biology, the Conklin Medal from the Society for Developmental Biology, and the CIHR Michael Smith Prize in Health Research, Canada's most prestigious health research award. She's a fellow of both the Royal Society of London and the Royal Society of Canada, and a foreign associate of the U.S. National Academy of Science. And most recently, in June of 2013, was recognized with the Ross G. Harrison Medal, a Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Society of Developmental Biologists. We are both privileged and honored to have her with us today. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. Janet Rossent.
Exactly. All right. Well, it really is an extraordinary honor to be here today and to join in the celebration of Dr. Clermont and the naming of the histology lab. When I was asked to give this lecture, I couldn't say no. When I first came to Canada in 1977, some of my heroes in research were represented by Canadian scientists. And two of my heroes were Leblanc and Clermont. The other two, Till and McCulloch. And one of the first things I did when I joined the faculty at Brock University was to travel to meet my heroes. And I met C.P. Leblanc. I came, I'm a young faculty member. I just wrote, said, could I come and visit? And he introduced me to Dr. Clermont. And I have to say that both of them, C.P. Leblanc and Yves Clermont, were incredibly generous to a young faculty member just trying to make her way in her career in Canada. And that has been something that I remember forever. Their, not just their science, but their openness and their willingness to really encourage young people. And we heard about that today, that Dr. Clermont, of course, is a fantastic teacher. But they're not only teachers, they're mentors. And I certainly owe both of them a debt of gratitude. So that's why I'm here. And what I want to do today, I changed the title from what was on the description and called it this instead, Stem Cells from 1953 to Future Therapy. So what was it that happened in 1953? It's been mentioned already. Something that the American Society for Cell Biology called the other big paper of 1953. You may remember what the other one was. Some sort of DNA stuff, I don't know. But this was the other big paper of 1953, and it really was the foundational paper that described the concept of stem cells, that you could have a self-renewing cell, in this case within the testis, a stem cell that could divide and self-renew, but then would give off as specialized daughters, or maybe they should be sons in the testis, daughter cells that would go on then to form specialized cells of the sperm. And in that paper, Clermont and Leblanc really described this concept of a renewing population, so that the title is the renewal of spermatogonia in the rat. They went on using descriptive studies and radiotography to really look at the stem cell, not just in the testis, but also in the intestine and other systems. And that led on and underlay the later work, a decade later, from Till and McCulloch, who developed the first functional assay for a stem cell. So these Leblanc and Clermont were looking within the tissue, within the intact tissue, and essentially working out from histology and labeling studies that there must be a stem cell. Till and McCulloch were the first to isolate stem cells from the bone marrow and, using a transplant assay, demonstrate that single cells could indeed self-renew and repopulate and be multipotent in their ability to make many cell types. So really then, this was the beginning of what we think of as stem cell biology today. And although stem cell biologists themselves often argue about what the definition of a stem cell is, this is mine. And I think Leblanc and Clermont would be in more or less in agreement. We could have a discussion maybe later. A stem cell is a cell that can divide indefinitely, self-renewing itself, producing copies of itself, but as well producing specialized cell types. So you can have divisions like this one here, in which a cell divides, produces two daughters that are different from the founding cell. That is not a stem cell. That's a differentiated division. You can have a situation where a stem cell can just self-renew and maintain itself. But the most interesting divisions, and the ones that were recognized by Clermont and Leblanc in the testis, are these here, where you have a cell that, when it divides, makes one copy of itself and one differentiated cell, so an asymmetric cell division. And you can see that if this continues, every time the cell divides, it does that, then you're retaining the stem cell, but producing essentially endless differentiated progeny as well. So it's that power of self-renewal that really underlies the excitement around stem cells. So Clermont Leblanc first described them in the testis, and a stem cell in the testis is a very restricted stem cell. It only gives rise to one cell type, the spermatogonia. But there are many other kinds of stem cells we now know in many different tissues and at all stages of development. And essentially, more or less, as we think about it, if you start with the beginning of development with the egg, going through to the blastocyst and then through to sort of the whole of organogenesis until final differentiated cell types, then cells are becoming essentially progressively specialized. The egg has the capacity to make everything. The blastocyst also contains pluripotent cells from which we can obtain embryonic stem cells, which I'll talk about in a minute. But as the tissues become more specialized, then we end up with what we could call adult stem cells. But although they can self-renew, like the spermatogonial stem cell, they are restricted in their outcomes. They're not pluripotent or totipotent. They've sort of forgotten some of the things they can do. So skin cells make skin cells, blood cells make blood cells, and neural stem cells make brain cells. And this is a forward progression, so essentially becoming more and more specialized. And at all the stages along the way, it's possible in many of these tissues to isolate now those stem cells, and in many cases grow them in culture and show that they can retain this self-renewal capacity and retain the lineage commitment from whence they came. So that means that when you look at stem cells, there are different kinds of stem cells. There are pluripotent stem cells that make many cell types, and embryonic stem cells are the archetype of the pluripotent stem cell. And then there are restricted stem cells, tissue-specific or organ-specific stem cells, the spermatogonial stem cell, blood stem cells, the ones described first by Till and McCullough, skin, gut, brain, many, many other tissues. But they are restricted. They have lost some of their capacity, but they still can self-renew. One of the things that I always test students on, or even the public when I give these kind of lectures, is there is this concept that a stem cell must be pluripotent or multipotent. And of course, that just is not the case. And spermatogonial stem cells are the archetype of a stem cell. They're the first ones described, but they only make one cell type. They make lots and lots of that cell type throughout life. It's a very active stem cell situation, but only one cell type. So the concept for stem cell does not require pluripotency or multipotency. However, when we are thinking, as people are now in the regenerative medicine field, about the use of stem cells for regenerative medicine, then we're really thinking more about cells that have more multipotent capacity so that they could repair many, many tissues. So the excitement about stem cells tends to be around the more multipotent cells rather than those that are of single tissue origin. So stem cells, because their self-renewal capacity, means they could provide replacement cells for many degenerative diseases and indeed traumatic injuries. And for stem cell therapy to work, whatever kind of stem cell one uses, an embryonic stem cell or an adult cell, there are a number of different things that have to be in place. So this is a very active field worldwide, but there are still a lot of problems going from the stem cell in the petri dish to a treatment in a patient. I'm certainly not going to go through all of these today, but as we go through the talk, you'll see how they come into play a little bit. So you must have an endless supply of cells. That's what stem cells are. That's good. They have to be stable. They have to keep remembering what they were. We don't want them changing as they grow in culture. They have to be safe. The nice thing about stem cells is that they divide indefinitely. The bad thing about a stem cell is that it divides indefinitely, which gives it this capacity to be potentially tumorigenic. Stem cells that have them, you would like to have stem cells that have the capacity to make every cell type so you could fix many, many kinds of disease situations. And from those stem cells, of course, you'd have to be able to make the right cell types you need to repair a tissue. You still have to avoid immune rejection unless you have tissue-matched stem cells. And in all these cases, whatever disease, whether it's diabetes, whether it's burns, whether it's eye diseases, you need a good clinical protocol to actually take these cells that you've devised, if you like, in culture, and get them back into the right place to survive and function. So work is proceeding apace in many areas on all of these. But if we think about this one, stem cells that have the potential to make all specialized cell types, it's that broad-based capacity that has led to the excitement around pluripotent stem cells that can make multiple cell types. So where do pluripotent stem cells come from? Well, they come from the areas in the embryo where there are cells that are still pluripotent and have not really decided to become restricted to tissue types. And the first and most well-known pluripotent stem cell arises from the very early embryo. These are the embryonic stem cells. They arise from what's called the blastocyst stage, which I'll show you again in a minute. And they're a subset of cells within the blastocyst that normally give rise to the entire fetus. So not surprisingly, when you isolate them, they can make every cell type of the body. It's also been shown in the mouse that you can get a pluripotent cell from a slightly later stage called the epiblast stem cell. You can isolate them from the genital ridges, from the germ cells, because they also, although they are specialized cells, they have capacity to become reactivated and pluripotent in development. There is also, interestingly, coming back to the testis, there's recent work showing that spermatogonial cells can be, under certain circumstances, reactivated to be pluripotent. And then, even more famously these days, you can induce pluripotency in adult cells, the so-called induced pluripotent stem cell. So all sorts of different pluripotent cells. Embryonic stem cells, however, are still the gold standard, and they were first derived in the mouse from the blastocyst by two groups, Martin Evans and Matt Kaufman in Cambridge and Gail Martin in San Francisco, same time in 1981. Martin Evans shared the Nobel Prize with Smithies and Capecchi in 2007 for his work, and Smithies and Capecchi were the ones who showed that you could undertake targeted mutagenesis in embryonic stem cells. And mouse embryonic stem cells have transformed mammalian genetics because you can change genes in the cells in culture, and because these cells think they come from the embryo, if you put them back in the embryo, they can recapitulate development, make germ cells, and you can take a mutant from a cell in culture and make it into a mouse. But if we think about the blastocyst, this is what's shown here, this is the mouse blastocyst. Those pluripotent cells, those ES cells, are coming from this group of pink cells here. These pink cells are stained with an antibody to a transcription factor called OCT4. And OCT4 is a famous gene involved in pluripotency. And experiments from my lab and many other labs over many years using chimeras have shown that these epiblast cells indeed are pluripotent. They give rise to the entire fetus. But a blastocyst has other cell types as well. It has an outer layer of cells called the trophectoderm, and a layer of cells on the cell surface here called the primitive endoderm. And those two other two cell types we showed actually give rise to extra embryonic cell types. The outer cells form the trophoblast layers of the placenta, and these cells form the endoderm layers of the yolk sac. So the mouse blastocyst has three cell lineages, only one of which makes the fetus itself. The other two are used by the embryo to survive in the uterine environment. It's particularly for a mammalian embryo, it's necessary to have a yolk sac and a placenta. So the blastocyst has set aside a small group of pluripotent cells, but has spent most of its time making these specialized cell types. And my lab has shown that you can derive from those other two cell types, the trophoblast and the primitive endoderm, you can also derive stem cell lines. So if we take this mouse blastocyst, these cells, the epiblast cells, give rise to embryonic stem cells. They express lineage-specific transcription factors, OCT4 and NANOG. And if you put them back into a blastocyst, they contribute to the embryo itself. These were LACZ-expressing cells. You see them throughout the fetus. But those cells don't make the endoderm of the yolk sac, no blue cells, and no blue cells in the placenta. So that's why they're called pluripotent cells and not totipotent cells. They are restricted. They're not completely able to make every cell type, but they retain the capacity to make the fetus. So we showed that you can take the trophectoderm and generate trophoblast stem cells, which also self-renew indefinitely in culture, express their own lineage-specific transcription factors, and now when you put them back in the blastocyst, they contribute to the layers of the placenta, but not to the fetus itself. And then finally, more recently, we showed that we could get what we call Zen cells, which come from the primitive endoderm. They have their own transcription factors, and they give rise to the endoderms of the yolk sac. So that says then that the mouse blastocyst is a pretty good source of stem cells, and we can use these stem cells to understand the lineage relationships in the early embryo. So ES cells are pluripotent and not totipotent. How pluripotent are they? If we think that these pluripotent cells one day could be used from the human to make every cell type in the body, we'd like to show that embryonic stem cells really can make every cell type of the body. And so we asked whether they were capable of making a mouse. And this was an experiment that was done by my colleague András Nagy and myself several years ago now, in which we used a genetic trick to show that we could derive mouse fetuses and live mice entirely from embryonic stem cells. And what we did was make a composite embryo in which the embryonic stem cells shown here, we know they can make the embryo proper in the mesoderm of the yolk sac, but they don't like making trophectoderm and primitive endoderm. I showed you that just now. And we knew from the literature that if you make a mouse embryo tetraploid, which you can do by fusing the two cells together, so it's double the amount of DNA per cell, then these embryos can go on and make trophoblast and primitive endoderm, but they're not very good at making the embryo itself. So if you put these two together, the only way this can survive as a viable conceptus is if the ES cells take over the fetal compartment, supported by the tetraploid cells in the placenta. And that's what you see here, an entirely blue fetus and an entirely green placenta. If you have good ES cells, and there are lots of good ES cells around right now, you can actually very readily, with this approach, make mice that are entirely ES-derived. These are just a set that András and Marina made a while ago now from a GFP expressing lines. These are little pups. They're all running around. They're all green, every cell in their body. Their germline is derived from the embryonic stem cells. They're viable. They're fertile. They're perfectly normal. And all the cells derived from cells that have been grown for many passages in a petri dish. And I still think that's quite a remarkable experiment, and it does really support that the embryonic stem cell is an entirely, a highly pluripotent cell. So with that discovery that these cells really are highly pluripotent really helped to trigger a big push to derive human embryonic stem cells, because it suggested then that not that you wanted to make humans from these cells, but that they would be cells that could make multiple cell types. So that was first achieved, of course, by Jamie Thompson in 1998, where working with a similar approach, but not the same, as we'll talk about later, to the mouse, taking a blastocyst, he was able to derive these colonies of cells in culture, human embryonic stem cells. And since then, he and many others have shown that these cells appear also to be pluripotent, that you can take the cells and change the culture conditions in a variety of different ways, and they will differentiate into many, many different cell types in the petri dish, or you can transplant them back into an immune-compromised mouse, and they'll make a teratoma containing tissues and cells of a variety of cell types. So human embryonic stem cells, then, derivation of these leads on to the potential that these might be possible therapeutic cells that could be used for regeneration. Still remembering all those things that I told you on the list of good things that have to happen before they could be used. So it's interesting that human ES cells were derived, but if you just look at these cells, they kind of don't quite look even like the mouse cultures. And it's become apparent over the years that human ear cells and mouse ear cells are really probably not quite equivalent, that they may not represent exactly the same stage of development. So are mouse and ear cells the same? So we really need to understand a little bit more about the origin of these cells in the blastocyst and what the signals are that promote self-renewal in the embryonic stem cell in the mouse and in the human. So in the mouse, here are the three different stem cell lines that we can obtain from a mouse blastocyst. We have the embryonic stem cells, the trophoblast stem cells, and the Xen cells. And interestingly, all three cell lines depend in different ways on FGF signaling. And it's particularly FGF signaling through the canonical RAS-MAP kinase pathway. Initially, embryonic stem cells were grown in the presence of leukemia inhibitory factor, but more recently, Austin Smith's lab has shown that you get the best pluripotency by growing the cells in inhibitors of FGF signaling and also inhibitors of GSK3. So blocking FGF signaling pushes cells towards pluripotency and stops them making trophoblast or primitive endoderm. So you only get embryonic stem cells when you outgrow a blastocyst in these conditions. When we first derived trophoblast stem cells, we grew them in exactly the opposite conditions. We added FGF4, and they're absolutely dependent on FGF4 for their self-renewal, plus also activin TGF-beta signaling. So opposite here, block FGF, we get ES cells, take the same blastocyst, and it's the TS cells that will grow in the presence of FGF4. Xen cells also require FGF4 for their initiation, but not for their self-renewal. Actually, we don't know what causes a self-renewal of Xen cells. That still needs to be explored. You require conditioned medium. We don't know what the component is. But you must have FGF4 to promote Xen cells in the first place. So it looks as though the stem cells are derived under different FGF conditions. Does this reflect what's going on in the embryo? Is the embryo using FGF in a way to decide whether to become trophoblast, epiblast, endoderm, or trophoblast? Well, the answer there seems to be yes, actually. If we go back and look at a blastocyst, this is now a 3.5-day blastocyst. Remember that first blastocyst I showed you was a beautiful segregation of the epiblast and primitive endoderm? This is a slightly earlier one. And now at this stage, the outside cells, the trophectoderm cells, are already restricted, and they show expression of CDX2, which is a very necessary trophoblast factor. But the inner cell mast cells here are actually a mixture of cells. There's no obvious spatial organization here, and there are GATA6 positive, that's an endoderm marker, and NANOG positive, that's an epiblast marker, and then there are some cells that seem to be double positive, but they're all in a random mixture. So you start with this heterogeneous, what we first described in 2006, and Claire Schozer, who first described this in my lab, called a salt and pepper distribution. She was French. What would it be in French? Anyway, she called it salt and pepper. What's interesting, though, is that that salt and pepper pattern actually, of course, actually resolves over time. And if you can see it here with a GFP marker that marks the developing primitive endoderm, you see it coming on within the inner cell mass, not just on the surface. There are cells enclosed here. And then over time, some of those cells will move to the surface, like that one, and stay there. Other cells, you see one here, I think, that ends up in the inside, actually dies. So over time, over the 24 hours, that random mixture segregates itself out into this beautiful layer, single cell layer of primitive endoderm on the surface. So you're starting with a heterogeneous mixture. Something about the development of those cells leads to their lineage segregation. But what sets up the initial difference between these cells and how does it get influenced? Well, that's where this knowledge that when you make embryonic stem cells, you block FGF signaling, and when you make Xen cells, you add FGF, led us to believe that maybe in the embryo itself, FGF was determining whether you were going to be epiblast or primitive endoderm. And that turns out to be true. And that's two different sets of experiments. First of all, if you take embryos and grow them from the 8-cell stage through to the blastocyst in the presence of an FGF receptor inhibitor or an ERK inhibitor, so the downstream kinase pathways, then instead of this mixture, sort of heterogeneous mixture that you see in the control embryos, then in these embryos, all the cells become nanopositive within the inner cell mass, and maybe one remaining Gardasil 6-type cell. So pushing all the cells, no change in cell number, but every cell is now an epiblast cell. So block FGF signaling, everybody goes epiblast. Importantly, Yojiro Yamanaka and Frederick Lanner in the lab did this, the opposite experiment. So this just says FGF signaling is necessary to make primitive endoderm. But is it actually instructive? Are you reading out levels of FGF signaling? The answer seems to be yes, because you can send cells in the opposite direction by treating them with excess FGF. So now if you grow embryos in the presence of high levels of FGF from the 8-cell stage on, then again, we get this mosaic at the normal, in the controls, and in the treated ones, all the cells within the inner cell mass become primitive endoderm. Frederick went on to do a series of experiments, of which I'm only going to show one here, to look at the time course when the cell, when the embryo is responsive to FGF. And the bottom line is that the embryo is reading out FGF signals in the inner cell mass at the time when you're seeing that heterogeneity. Individual cells, we believe, are reading local FGF signals and responding to go either epiblast or primitive endoderm. And if you interfere by exogenously blocking or adding FGF in that window, you can shift the whole population. So here, for example, is one experiment where the embryo is grown in the presence of FGF4 all the way through to E4.5. Everybody goes primitive endoderm. So you pushed everybody. If you take the same embryo, and at early blastocyst stage, it's been in the presence of FGF4 up to that point, and now you add the inhibitor, you can send cells all back the other way, and they become epiblast. And if you wait a little bit later before you add the inhibitor, then you can actually regenerate the mosaic. So it's very sensitive to timing and levels of FGF. We don't know exactly how the embryo is reading this. There's lots of discussion we could have on that point. There is some more. There are questions about how you initiate the asymmetry, how the heterogeneity, how that resolves over time. Many interesting questions. But essentially, we think that there's a threshold level of FGF signaling over which you become primitive endoderm and below which you stay as epiblast. And that in a normal embryo, you're kind of working in the mid-range here, so you end up with this mixture of cells. But if we take out a signaling pathway component or treat with inhibitors, then we send cells all towards, keep cells all as epiblast. And if we push cells the other way, then everybody becomes primitive endoderm. So the model looks like this. You start with a mixture of cells. They differ in their level of ligand and receptor. The cells that are high ligand signal to the high receptor. You start to turn on downstream transcription factors, which can also negatively interact with each other. The cells change their surface properties, start to move apart, no longer talk to each other, and lineage restriction is in place. So that's easily said. The molecular details still need to be worked out. But it's a nice model, because what we also know is that FGF4 produced in these cells in the inner cell mass is also the signal that makes trophoblast stem cells proliferate. And so these cells within the inner cell mass, if they're touching the trophoblast, these cells of the trophoblast will proliferate to form trophoblast stem cells. So the embryo is using FGF4 from the cells of the inner cell mass in two ways. One, to influence epiblast primitive endoderm formation, and two, for the self-renewal of trophoblast stem cell. So that explains then how you can get those three different stem cell lines under different FGF conditions from the same blastocyst. So we have a pretty good idea of what's going on in the mouse blastocyst, and FGF signaling levels are clearly dominant and important. So is that true in the human? Well, the answer is no, apparently not. It's always a little bit worrying when you're somebody like me who's worked on a mouse embryo for all of her research career, to suddenly start worrying that what we found out in the mouse makes a beautiful story and is a fundamental developmental problems, but may not be the same in the embryo that we now increasingly need to care about, and that's the human embryo. So is it fundamentally different? We don't know, but there certainly are differences. So human embryonic stem cells are not grown in inhibitors of FGF signaling. Human embryonic stem cells are grown in the presence of FGF. Human ES cells were isolated in the presence of FGF and activin, the exact same conditions that in the mouse promote trophoblast stem cell proliferation. And if you didn't have the trophoblast, in the mouse would promote Zen cell formation. So in the human, this is the pathway you need for self-renewal of human embryonic stem cells. So that might just be that we missed the boat, that when people were deriving these cells, they got a later cell type, and I'll describe that in a minute, that is responsive to FGF. So maybe they missed it. Maybe it's possible to go back in the early embryo and try the conditions under which in the mouse, essentially, you could block primitive endoderm formation and get embryonic stem cells. Well, three groups have tried that. Three recent publications have taken human embryos and treated them with FGF-ERK inhibitors, which I showed you in the mouse would block primitive endoderm formation and turn everybody epiblast. But in the human, that does not seem to be the case. In these two studies, there was no effect on primitive endoderm formation. It formed quite happily. And this paper here showed the same thing. This paper showed that you might get a few more epiblast cells, so maybe there's something going on here, but you did not suppress primitive endoderm formation in the same way as you do in the mouse. Suggesting then that I'll tell you what it suggests in a minute. So there's differences then. The embryo is not responding, so not surprising then that when you try the mouse embryonic stem cell culture conditions, you don't get stem cells growing out in culture. So what are human embryonic stem cells? It's been suggested that they're much more equivalent to another pluripotent stem cell type that I mentioned briefly at the beginning, and that's the mouse epiblast-like stem cell, which are derived from the early post-implantation embryo, a bit later than the blastocyst. That's this embryo here. And these are the cells here that come from the epiblast of the blastocyst but are now forming what's called the egg cylinder. And these cells are now FGF responsive. They, if grown in the presence of FGF4 and activin, they make these flattened colonies that look very, very similar to human embryonic stem cells. They express pluripotency markers. They can differentiate into lots and lots of different cell types. So when you compare the properties of human embryonic stem cells and mouse epistem cells, we find that they are very similar but not identical. So mouse ES cells are lift-dependent. Epistem cells do not respond to lift, nor do human ES cells. These two cell types are FGF activin-dependent. Both of them have gone further and have got exon activation, whereas exon activation has not occurred in the ES cell in the mouse. They have some physical properties that seem to be different as well. Both of these express trophoblast markers in interesting ways. Only these cells contribute to chimeras and these cells don't. But there are some differences. The marker expression is not identical. So human ES cells, though, do appear to represent a slightly different pluripotent state. So why all these differences? What is going on? This must relate somehow back to these differences in the responsiveness of the human and mouse blastocyst to FGF pathway inhibitors. And it's possible that perhaps this sort of naive pluripotent state that you can capture by blocking FGF in the mouse is just very, very transitory in the human embryo, and we just can't capture it. So that when you do capture and freeze and self-renew cells in the human, they really are more like these later epistem cells. That's the only cell type you can capture. It's possible that we haven't hit the right period. We know in the mouse that primitive endoderm gene expression initially is independent of FGF signaling. So maybe in the human, there's an FGF-independent period for just a longer period of time. Maybe we haven't gone late enough to find the FGF-dependent time. The other possibility that we're certainly still exploring is that FGF is not the only game in town. that there can be redundant signaling pathways that are active in the mouse and the human, but at different levels and at different times in the different species. Whatever's going on here, this is a caveat that we all need to have at the back of our mind when working with human or mouse cells, that there are developmental differences. And when you're deriving and differentiating stem cells for human therapy and trying to use developmental biology to drive your decisions of what you want to do next, you do have to think about whether human and mouse are actually the same. So there's still a great deal of need to do some further cross-comparison of these two different cell types. So that's sort of a little where we are in terms of understanding how you can, what we know in the embryo can relate to stem cells that come from the blastocyst. But now I want to switch gears a bit and talk about what we can do with pluripotent stem cells. And in particular, what we can do with the newest guy on the block in terms of pluripotent stem cells, and those are the so-called induced pluripotent stem cells. And this, of course, was the famous discovery from Shinya Yamanaka, first published in 2006 in The Mouse. Got a lot of scientific attention, but not much press attention. Next year, he and Jamie Thompson separately did the same thing in humans, and now the press started to wake up and take notice, and indeed the whole world took notice. Because what Shinya had shown was that you could take tissue from the adult body, skin, and now many other cell types, and grow them in the presence of four transcription factors and take those cells right back to the beginning of development so that they behave like embryonic stem cells. This meant that you can essentially derive pluripotent stem cells from anyone in this room, any person with any disease, any stage of life, many, many tissues. You have an endless supply of potentially therapeutic and useful cells for studying human biology and disease. So you can take these cells, you can now expand them, you can differentiate them using the power of pluripotency, and now you have potentially, in the end of the day, rejection-free transplantation. If we take your cells and you need a transplant, we grow them in culture, we differentiate them, we can put your cells back into you. The first therapy trial doing this is just getting going in Japan with iPS cells, using them for replacement of the retinal pigment epithelium in various forms of macular degeneration. They will be patient-specific RPE cells, so this is actually beginning to happen. But the other more exciting thing in the short run, and certainly something that I find very exciting, is that we can model human biology and human disease in the petri dish. All of a sudden, we have access to the very earliest stages of human development in ways we never had before, because we're going back to embryonic stem cells right to the beginning of development, and we can take them through the stages of development into the specialized adult cells. So we can understand human biology. But more than that, if we take stem cells from patients with different genetic diseases, we can begin to model human disease in the petri dish and devise new treatments and new therapies. A lot of interest also in drug toxicology. I won't talk about that today. But many, many uses for these iPS cells. So that, of course, 2006, the first paper, the Nobel Prize for Medicine last year went to John Gurdon, for essentially the concept of being able to reprogram back to pluripotency using nuclear transfer in the frogs, and then Shinya Yamanaka for this amazing work in the mouse and human system. So my lab and many other labs are interested and have been making human embryonic iPS cells. At SickKids, we believe that there's a huge potential to use human iPS cells to help us understand many of the diseases that we see in the hospital. Because when you have disease in a kid, then the genetic components are very, very high. Almost all the kids we see coming through the hospital have rare diseases, and they have clear genetic underpinning. And of course, not only are they highly genetic, that is, we can find genes and we can model them in the make the cells or take the iPS cells in those patients and have the genetic alterations, but because they're pediatric diseases, we can follow early development and intervene in the petri dish. So it's a very exciting thing for everybody, particularly exciting in the pediatric area. So can we use human iPS cells to study human disease in the petri dish? And what's our favorite disease? Well, the disease that we've decided to focus on in the lab is cystic fibrosis. So there's a sick kids tradition in cystic fibrosis. It's long been studied. There's a very large cystic fibrosis center, a cystic fibrosis database. And, of course, the gene for cystic fibrosis was cloned by Lapchi Choi when he was at sick kids quite a few years ago now. So the CF gene encodes the CFTR chloride transporter molecule. Oops, sorry. And if you upset this molecule, you fail to get proper chloride transport, leading to the problems that we see in CF. So what we just wanted to do is to derive iPS cells from cystic fibrosis patients and see if we could generate lung epithelium from them that we could begin to use to test new therapies and maybe one day actually produce cells that could be used to replace a dying lung tissue. So cystic fibrosis, I don't need to go into this in any great detail. You know it's an autosomal recessive disease, and it is one of the more common ones in North America and Europe. We've increased the survival for patients with CF over the years, and the mean survival now is around 46 years, but there is no cure. And most of the better survival is not being around trying to cure the gene or replace it in any way, just improving the symptoms. The final treatment is lung transplant, and that is not something that is really a lifetime cure either. So there's still a big issue here. So all the mutations lie in the CFTR gene. The most common mutation is this delta F508, which is a in-frame deletion that causes misfolding of the protein that can't get out of the ER. So a lot of hope and beginning to see drugs that could actually address this misfolding and put CFTR on the surface. But we know that even with this same mutation, that patients can have different phenotypes. So there are known genetic modifiers that affect the severity of this phenotype. And again, groups at SickKids in international consortia have identified some of the genetic modifiers, and we have patients with a different genetic backgrounds. So we are now making iPS cells from patients with the same mutation on different genetic backgrounds, and we will hope then to test known drugs and any new drugs that come out in a sort of personalized medicine approach to ask whether they're going to actually be effective on the individual patients depending on the genetic background. So what we wanted to do then, so the experiment, you can see it worked because I showed you the pretty pictures on the first slide there. This is work from Amy Wong, who's postdoc in the lab, and a joint postdoc between my lab and James Ellis's lab. And she set out to try to make a source of airway epithelial cells that we could use to do patient-specific drug screens, to identify novel therapeutic correctors, and then again, in the end, potential future approaches for airway regeneration. So it's not basically, if you want to do any of these kind of differentiations from a human embryonic stem cell, you have to think about normal development. The way that we go forward is to repeat normal development. And that means adding a succession of changes of cytokines, cell surfaces, 3D constructions, air-liquid interfaces. So in Amy's case, the final protocol that she worked up is shown here. First of all, you have to make the right germ layer. So with activin and WNT3A, you can push almost all the cells towards germ layer formation. Now you've got definitive endoderm, but you want to make the right bit, so you want to make it into anterior foregut, and that requires FGF2 and sonic hedgehog. And then you want to specify lung versus other foregut derivatives, and that's a mixture of FGFs and BMPs. And now you've got the progenitors of the lung. You have to start growing these cells and maturing them into lung epithelium. And that's done in the presence of this Begum medium, which is a specific medium with a variety of additives that promotes lung epithelial development and cell growth. And then finally, if you want to get a functional epithelium that's going to actually transport ions, it has to be polarized, it has to be tight junction coupled. And the way you do that in the lung is put it in a situation the way it would be in the final lung. That's at an air-liquid interface. So that's how the lung epithelium normally functions. So these cells were then put onto an air-liquid interface and studied in that situation. And indeed, by the time you get to that point, then what we can see is that with the cells that we generate from this are turning on markers of the proximal airways. And the blue cells, the blue bars here, are our differentiated cells. The gray is a lung epithelial cell line as a control. And there's this fetal lung and adult lung as additional controls. And we can see that genes like SOX17, CFTR itself, goblet cell marker, a ciliated cell marker, basal cells and basal cell progenitors, all those markers are coming on nicely here. But interestingly, and good for us because CF is a disease of the proximal airways, what we found here was that the proximal airway markers, the alveolar markers, the clearasil markers, do not come on in these particular culture conditions. The cells look good. It's not a homogeneous situation. This is a nice picture of a cluster of these cells. So we never get the whole dish forming one tight epithelium. But we get big enough areas of nicely coupled epithelium, showing ZO1 expression here, and cytokeratin. If you do that, you can actually see that roughly about half of the cells in the culture are epithelial, express CFTR, and a ciliated lung epithelium. And in those areas, those 50% of the cultures that form this epithelium, then we see that CFTR is actually localized apically, as you would hope. So if you turn it sideways here, we can see that CFTR is on the surface. So these are all wild-type embryonic stem cells. We also then went on and made and characterized CFTR mutant iPS cells and showed they have the same phenotypes. I'm not going to show you that here. But then in collaboration with Christine Baer's lab, who really works at the function of CFTR and develops functional assays, then this is a chloride conductance assay where you stimulate these cells, and in a wild-type cell, you see this chloride efflux here. This is just treating the cells without the stimulus, the wild-type cells, no efflux. And then these iPS cells treated with the inducer cannot turn on a chloride transport. So it really does appear then as though we've got a situation where we can measure chloride transport and mutant cells do not. So are these cells really going to be useful for testing drugs? Here's a proof of principle, and that is that here again, this is the wild-type cells, and we see CFTR on the cell surface of the cell membrane. This is an iPS, this is the same lung epithelial cells derived from the CF iPS cell. We see that CFTR is not on the cell surface. You see the little blobs, and that CFTR is stuck within the ER. However, if we treat these cultures with a small molecule, C18, that is a candidate for refolding and repackaging CFTR to the cell surface, then we see that it's not as good as this, but we now do see CFTR coming back to the cell membrane, shown clearly here in the overlay. This is not enough CFTR to give us chloride transport, so it's not perfect, but maybe that's because the molecule isn't perfect. But certainly as proof of principle, then, we have a situation where we can test these drugs. So it's a promising protocol. It's nice. We're getting the right cell types. We're getting them producing the right molecules. We're getting them to respond as airway cells would. And we think that we should be able to improve this over time and turn it into a really robust assay. But what are the problems? So here's what we have. It is a promising protocol. We definitely get proximal airway epithelial cells. We get sheets of them. It's useful for patient-specific drug discovery. And we should be able to model CF in vitro, so we can model function. We really want to start looking at these delta 508 pathologies on different genetic backgrounds, and we're doing that right now. And again, perhaps in the long run, transplantation. But there are some problems, and I think I made it clear already that it's not a homogeneous culture. 50% or so of the cells are the cells we want. And what else have we got in the culture? Well, we've got a little bit of various things. We don't have things other than definitive endoderm, but we do have some other foregut derivatives coming up in the culture. So here, for example, this is the differentiated cells are the green cells. These are just respective adult tissues. And then this is our lung epithelial cell line, transformed cell line that's used as a control. And you can see that we get some cells expressing the pancreatic marker, thyroid marker, liver marker, and another liver marker. So there are mixed cell populations here. So this is one of the challenges that Amy's working on very hard right now. Can we sort out the earlier progenitors? Can we improve the differentiation early so we drive cells more towards lung epithelium? And or could we sort out the cells at different stages and enrich for lung epithelial cells and take them through to the final differentiation? And I certainly don't have the final answer to that either. These studies are ongoing. But one of the things that we think might be a useful thing to try to do would be to sort of take the differentiation forward to a stage at which we can get a multipotent lung progenitor and maybe purify the population at that stage, and then that use that progenitor to be expanded to differentiate into lung epithelium. So how would we get a multipotent lung progenitor out of our differentiated human ESL cultures? What stage is the best one to go into to really sort those cells out? Well, I'm a developmental biologist, so what do we do then? Well, we return to embryonic development. Can't really go into the human, but we can go back into the mouse, and we can go back in at the relevant stages that we know are equivalent to the human. And so this is work of Melanie Biodo, who's another postdoc in the lab, and she's looking at mouse development and looking to see whether she can identify early lung progenitors, multipotent progenitors, during fetal lung development. And to do that, she's made a very nice iris M. cherry knock-in into the NKX2.1 locus. And NKX2.1 is a marker of the lung epithelium from the very early stages right through to birth. And you can see here that if you just look at the developing lung, you see it beautifully outlining, this M. cherry is outlining the lung epithelium. And again, at 14.5 days as well, out here in the lung epithelium. NKX2.5 is expressed also in a couple of other places, and those come up in this mouse as well. So it's very cleanly predicting the normal expression of NKX2.1. So this gives us a nice marker to sort cells. So Melanie then went on and has sorted, actually, from both E14.5 and 12.5, the NKX-expressing cells, the epithelial cells, and then grown them in suspension culture. So she took both distal and proximal, so that is to say the cells that are going to give rise to the alveoli and the cells that are going to give rise to the airway. Lots of people are interested in the alveoli, but when we do it under the culture conditions that she was using, the distal cells, the distal epithelial cells, really don't do extraordinarily well. You do get some proliferation, but they don't persist for very long. Whereas the proximal airway cells, isolated and enriched for M. cherry, you see you get these beautiful cyst-like structures that grow in the cultures. And you can see that these are only in the M. cherry positive populations and not in the M. cherry negative populations. So these are derived from the lung epithelium. Now, these are nice cultures, but are they clonal? What are these little spheres here? So then what Melanie did was do a mixing experiment in which essentially she mixed the M. cherry cells that are red with cells isolated from the epithelium in a different way, using a different marker that expressed GFP, and then mixed them up in culture and grew them into these spheres. And what you see is quite nicely that essentially individual spheres appear to be clonal. You see very rarely do you actually see a mixed culture here. So they're spheres, but they're derived from a single cell. I'm not going to show you this, but you can dissociate these spheres and grow them into secondary spheres. So within these spheres, stem cells persist. So this is very similar to the neurosphere assay that has been used in the nervous system. So these spheres now contain stem cells and differentiated progeny, but there is a continuation of an epithelial stem cell. So this is a clonal culture. What can that clonal culture give rise to? Is it multipotent? The answer is yes, because if you stain these clonal cultures with a number of different lung markers, then you can find within individual colonies a expressing P63, markers of the ciliated cells, and also markers of goblet cells. So really they are complex. They contain multiple lung cell types. Not only can they do this in culture in these spheres, but could these actually be progenitors that we might be able to expand up and make into more functional tissues? So how would we test for lung function? Well, one of the assays that people have been using quite a lot in the lung is to do transplantations back into decellularized lung scaffolds. So you remove all the cells within the developing lung, and we're now doing a fetal lung at this point, and remove all the cells, and then ask whether your cells can actually repopulate the extracellular matrix scaffold that remains. And when you do that with these clonal cultures, then we do see that we can get repopulation of these cells, and they're organizing themselves within the decellularized scaffold into structures that look quite nicely like developing lung epithelium, again, with a number of different markers being expressed. So this, again, is preliminary data. This is a collaboration with Dr. Martin Post lab. So what are the future plans then? So Melanie's work in the mouse suggests that during fetal development, if we can isolate the lung epithelium using NKX2.5 as a marker, then we should be able to get expansion of these progenitors, and that these then might give us a substrate on which to apply our later differentiation protocol to really push all of the cells in the culture towards lung epithelium. So this is Amy's current culture. We've improved the process by getting better endoderm at the beginning. Starting well always helps the end game. But the next stage is to isolate progenitors in the middle here, expand them, and then move those through the rest of the differentiation. So this is the kind of work that if you want to take iPS cells or ES cells through to study disease, it's hard work. You simply have to work very hard, going backwards and forwards between development and normal development and the cells in culture, to really develop the appropriate culture conditions to study disease. And even more, of course, if we actually in the end want to take cells and use them for cell-based therapies. But it is an exciting time, and I think we really are in a situation where we've gone from 1953, from radioautography to stem cell therapy and regenerative medicine. The next 60 years, this is where we're going to be. I will stop there, and since this is a stem cell talk, I'll give you an advert. And just an advertisement for the annual meeting of the International Society for Stem Cell Research. It's going to be in Vancouver, in Canada. There are many Canadians on the program. I'm the current president of the Society International Society for Stem Cell Research. So I really, really would like to see you all in Vancouver next June. Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely, yes. And I think it's certainly going to be part of the solution for any regenerative any regenerative therapy aspect of it. So even in those decellularized scaffolds, all we're putting back is epithelium. You clearly need to put back the endothelium as well. Absolutely. It's they grow in very, very close association. That is going to be true, actually, in many other stem cell situations as well. And people are starting to do that now. It's just not as easy, obviously. It's easier to take one purified cell type, but in many situations, of course, stem cells don't grow as purified cells. They're growing in a niche, and the niche is provided by tissues like the endothelium. So, yes, absolutely. Yes. Well, I don't think the big head matters at the blastocyst stage, but yeah. So actually, if we just think about early development, so let me stop. There's this it's long been proposed that there is this sort of phylogenetic moment. Essentially, all embryos, all vertebrate embryos, go through a period sort of after gastrulation of establishing the body plan, where the Hox genes are laid down, and everything is really very similar. The phylotypic stage. But how you get there and how you come out of there differs considerably. And we think of that often mostly between things like fish and frogs and mammals. But even within mammalian systems, you're going to get differences. And some of the biggest differences are probably at the getting in stage. And part of the difference is that the first cell type that you make in a mammalian embryo is the trophectoderm that makes the placenta. And anyone who's ever looked at any different mammalian species will know that the placenta is hugely variable across mammals. Implantation can hardly occur at all. It can be very invasive. You can get many different... Because we're still playing around with it, I think. Evolutionarily, this is a new development. So the first cell type you make is a trophoblast. It's going to have different properties. So that's the niche in which the pluripotent cells are arising. So I think that you're going to see, and you are seeing, considerable differences. So if you look at cows, if you look at sheep, if you look at many different mammals, the cell types are the same, the proportions are different, the timing is different, and it looks as though, to some degree, the mechanisms of how you establish those cell types and self-renewing is different. But once you get through that, and you gastrulate, then you're okay for a bit. But now you have another problem. You've got to get out the other end. And the final maturation of tissues, again, is clearly different. And that's where, we are not a mouse in the end of the day. We do have some physiological and other differences. And those are going to be critical, again, more for the regenerative therapy. So understanding where you start is important if you want to drive differentiation. You need to know what your starting material is. And then coming out the other end, you need to understand the physiological differences between human and other systems. So, yeah, we're going to have to keep doing both. The back. Oh, sorry, I chose. Sorry, that was my fault. Well, I think if you want robust iPS cells with non-integrating approaches, the two approaches that most sort of labs seem to be using now are either Sendai virus or episomal transcription factors. Those seem to be robust. All of the approaches where you can use small molecules, et cetera, are interesting experimentally, but are not robust enough. If you were sort of setting up a biobank, you wouldn't do that at this point. Yeah. Yeah. So the question is, if you're taking an aged cell and you're taking it back to the beginning of development, you're going to have problems. So I said you can get them from aged cells, and you can. It is less efficient as the cells get, as they use them from older people, but you still can do it, presumably because within those cells, within those samples, the efficiency is very low. So there's only a few cells that are really going to actually be transformed. Can you get mutations? That is one of the concerns. There has been sort of a bit, I would say, rather conflicting data on the sort of genetic heterogeneity in iPS cultures. It's been suggested that you can get copy number variants, but that they may actually arise during the reprogramming process, not necessarily because you're picking them up from the starting cell. So it's not entirely clear, but that is one of the concerns for therapeutic purposes with iPS cells, that they may be more subject to mutation and therefore perhaps cancer propensity than embryonic stem cells. So the safety concerns taking them to therapy are very important. I just come back from a stem cell meeting in China where that was certainly one of the discussion points. I mentioned that there is a starting for a new trial in Japan, and there were still quite a lot of questions in the audience about safety issues with those cells.
Okay, well, I'm not going to dare try it. I'll put it on my head because that'll cause a lot of problems. I just want to thank you most sincerely for that excellent talk. I have to say it was particularly gratifying for me personally to see you playing around with lung cells, since I'm a lung doctor, and I know Christine Baer. Please say hello for me. I think that the lung actually in many ways is the most challenging organ, so you're very brave to start there because it depends so much on three... That's right, like the hematological system or something. Because, of course, it depends so critically on three-dimensional geometry and the presence of multiple layers, as somebody mentioned about the vasculature. But nevertheless, I think that it's extremely exciting work, and we're very, very grateful that you were able to share it with us today. Thank you very, very much. And with that, I want to end the session. I want to thank you all for attending. I want to just take a second to acknowledge Dr. Bergeron here, who's sitting in the front row quite appropriately, because it's through his persistence, his incredible energy, and his constant nagging that all of this was possible today. So I want to acknowledge that and thank him very much for insisting that we do the right things, which he always does, and making sure that we had a wonderful celebration for Dr. Clermont, as well as a fantastic speaker for the Holmes Lecture. I encourage you all to look forward to next year's lecture. For those of you who are here for homecoming, welcome back and have a great time over the next couple of days. Thank you very much, everybody. To see so many students here. That's actually, I know that's great to see students.
Thank you so much for having it here.
Sanctus.